We made this.
Hello, and welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. Thank you for joining us for this patron roundtable discussion of Hybrid X-Files, those episodes that combine elements of the mythology and standalone episodes. I'm your host, Marlene Stemme. I'm joined today by Caredwin Foley. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to get into this.
Great. Adam Silva is also with us.
Hey, Adam. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for being on. And then Mara Jaker is here too. Hi, Mara.
Hi there. Thanks for including me.
Absolutely. So this is going to be part one of the roundtable discussion. And in this part, we're going to focus on the X-Files episodes that have stories with both Myth Arc and Monster of the Week elements. And we have discussed the classification system for X-Files that aren't quite the core mythology episodes, but aren't entirely standalone episodes either. I'm going to run through this scheme of the tiers of the mythology structure, and then we'll go through examples to see how well these categories do and don't work and what we think of them, and if we agree on the types of episodes that that we're using for the categories. So to begin with, we of course have our core mythology that is the central conspiracy of the show. And these are episodes that directly address in plot the central ongoing storyline of Mulder's search for Samantha, Scully's abduction, the government's complicity in alien colonization, hybridization, and other experiments, and the direct results of these activities. And of course, this shifted somewhat in later seasons and in the revival seasons 10 and 11, but really like the core of the myth arc of the show is what that those episodes would be. And then following from that, we have what we've termed the stealth mythology episodes. And these are episodes that don't begin as mythology episodes, but sort of sneak in the mythology elements and connect at some point within their plot to the central mythology. After that, we have the semi-mythology episodes, and that is categorized as a story that's based on the central mythology and has plot elements that are in common with the central mythology, but it doesn't really connect directly to the central mythology of the show over the course of the episode. Those, the stealth and the semi, are probably the ones that we'll mention the most, I would think. But we also have the mythology precursor episodes, which are episodes that have elements that have yet to appear in the myth arc, and that first appear in the sort of anthology episodes as potential suggestions of future myth arc ideas. And then there are, of course, the quasi-mythology episodes. And those are stories that have mythology characters, elements, themes, you know, analogies or parodies, but it doesn't really connect as a story to the central mythology. But I just wanted to put that out there as sort of a categorization scheme as we're going through.
Makes sense.
Let's go ahead and kind of go through some of our examples and episodes, and we can, you know, start and then discuss what we think of them. So, Mara, would you like to go first?
Sure. Yes, I sort of examined season one, and the three episodes that I focused on, I suppose, would probably all fall under the myth precursor, mythology precursor category. Mm-hmm. Conduit being one, sort of for obvious reasons. I mean, the emphasis on alien life, and then also Samantha and how much, you know, that would continue to affect Mulder and his search. And then also ICE, being that, you know, there's extraterrestrial parasitic organisms. And then obviously the government sort of trying to cover it up a little bit there at the end. And then Gender Bender, which is sort of the oddest, I think, of the bunch, just because the alien element I felt like was very much shoehorned into that one at the very end. And I don't know if they were going for shock value with that, or or they just felt compelled somehow to tie it to this overall theme of aliens or what, but those are the three that I came up with.
Yeah, I think that's a good point on Gender Bender, because it kind of became a precursor episode, but not until, you know, at least from what I would see or perceive, like not until the very end. It's like, oh, we could put, you know, aliens in this too. So whereas the others seem to be running throughout a little bit closer to that.
Definitely. I mean, certainly ICE, I felt like it's probably the most successful of the three in incorporating that. I've always had a soft spot for Conduit, too.
Well, with Conduit, I mean, if we agree that the girl was abducted, then, I mean, it does fit into the mythology a bit more than the others, just because the Ice and Gingerbender, they're dealing with aliens, but they're like a different alien species than has to do with the central mythology. So yeah, Conduit's kind of on the edge there, but it's maybe a little bit closer than the other two.
Definitely.
Hmm. Sort of like in a casual stroke, I would put Conduit and then like maybe Fallen Angel in some of the episodes like that together, because those seem like they're definitely heading towards something. They just don't know what yet. But I like the inclusion of Ice and Genderbender, sort of like the sort of early ideas forming, maybe.
I think like Fallen Angel and the pilot too sort of retroactively become more mythology episodes, because we do eventually see those things come back later in the series. They sort of become a little less anthology because some of those things are picked up later on in the series.
Yeah, it's interesting. Max, in some ways, as a character, you know, he has a few things in common with Dwayne Barry up until Dwayne Barry and Ascension. I mean, if the events of Dwayne Barry and Ascension had never happened, Dwayne Barry's life would have been this tragic, you know, repeated series of experimentations in the way that Max's was. And Max didn't take anybody down with him in the way that that Dwayne did. But it's interesting how those characters, you know, they're these kind of divergent figures in some way, but they share a lot of the same architecture.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about how they are two. They're both characters that were, you know, obviously had their life shook by being abducted and really changed the course of their lives.
I hadn't either, and I really hadn't thought of the contrast between them too, which I think is interesting. But it makes sense though, because Max does seem to be more of like an empathetic character, whereas Dwayne Barry is just saving himself, you know, in the end, which is, I guess, understandable. But then there's this other way to be that you see in Max.
Yeah, the teaser for Dwayne Barry when he's in his house and you're seeing like this flashback sequence to, I can't remember what year, but sometime in the 80s, of this abduction experience that he has. You know, there is this fear and this earnestness to him that kind of reminds you of what we've seen Max's experiences to be like, where he's a straight up victim. It's just that mm-hmm. what he chooses to do with that is so different from what Max chooses to do with it.
Well, right. Dwayne Barry suffered from a gunshot wound to his head that his personality. So he may have been, he probably was a more empathic and sympathetic character previous to that. But yeah, I think when you see his abductions, yeah. You see his, you know, getting his teeth drilled with a laser, you know, I think you definitely feel for him. So,
right.
You know, it makes you wonder, like, what would you have done to not be abducted again? Would you send someone else in your place?
Yeah, that's a good point, especially given the gunshot and that connection that they make to the Phineas Gage case, you know, that doesn't have that. Or that capacity is damaged in him. Adam, do you want to go with your first example?
Mine was the season 2 Red Museum, which I really like as an episode, but it's one of the stealth mythology episodes you mentioned, where it, you know, it begins really as what you would think is a standalone episode, but it eventually becomes, I think, pretty clearly a mythology episode, because we realize that, you know, these kids are being experimented on with, you know, purity control, which is what Scully found in the Erlenmeyer flask, was the experiments with the alien DNA. And it also has the Crew Cut Man, who was the Deep Throat's assassin. So he becomes involved and he gets killed. So that it follows up on that. And again, another thing that sort of becomes retroactively more important is that the Church of the Red Museum's date for the dawn of the new age, or whatever they call it, is 2012. You know, again, something that connects more. And also they mention the walk-ins spirits, which are come back in the CNN's eye closure. So there's a lot of things in there that are mythology, so I definitely consider it in that tier.
Do you think it's effective the way that they went into the sort of like sideline into the mythology? I do. I mean, it seems to me like it's the first like really stealth episode where like, oh, this does connect to the main thing. But I've read criticism about that as well, that it's kind of all over the place because of that.
Yeah, I like it. I don't feel like it's too over the place. I mean, it does spend, like, sort of the first half going down sort of different routes, but I think once it hits on, Scully says, this is purity control. I mean, it really, from there, explains everything that's going on, and from there it becomes clearly a mythology episode, because this is an experiment being conducted on people with alien DNA. And that's really that becomes the source of the story. And I think when it's the source of the story, I think it's that's sort of the definition of what mythology is. It just sort of sneaks up on you.
And I think they were definitely successful in misdirecting the viewers, especially since they'd already had a couple of episodes sort of dealing with cultish groups prior to that. That you really kind of truly believe that church is actually going to be at least somewhat involved in the criminal end of things. Yeah. So,
yeah, that's a great point. There are a lot of things that were like cult driven, and then also just like, they have the whole abduction motif, kids in the woods, what are they really doing, all of that, and it sort of speaks to some other force at work, and I think that's a good diversion as well. I hadn't thought of that.
Do you remember, does this episode fall before or after Die Hand über Letzt? Because that's kind of an interesting counterpoint.
It's before. The Museum is episode 10, I think, and Die Hand über Letzt is 14.
Yeah, those kind of recurring motifs around things happening with like weird stuff with teenagers, the pilot.
right.
Extremely different takes on that idea.
Yeah. Right.
And I think they did an excellent job of casting the leader of that cult. I mean, because I think from the beginning, he just seems like such a sinister figure.
And I wonder if I'm wrong about this, but I want to say that actor comes back later in the series.
I was just thinking that.
Ian Unzeit and Chloe, which is really funny, because again, you have the walk-in. Yeah.
Right.
I just thought of that, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think that...
No, he definitely comes back, because I was just thinking about his face.
Yeah.
While...
Okay, then it's... Yeah, that's an interesting connection there, you know.
So I actually would like to talk about a couple episodes together, because I think they have a lot of affinities with each other. And a lot of the crossover or kind of stealth mythology episodes that we've talked about so far are related to the alien conspiracy. But I want to talk about a couple of episodes that aren't actually connected to the alien aspect of the myth arc at all. And those are F Emasculata, which is also from season 2, and Pine Bluff Variant, which is its kind of season 5 counterpoint. These are two of the Contagion episodes that X-Files does, and they're also human experimentation episodes. And I find them incredibly fascinating for a couple reasons, but they have those motifs of government and corporate experimentation are really intrinsic to both of them. And something that I love about these episodes is that Mulder and Scully don't start out working a traditional X-File anyway. You know, even with Red Museum, you have this like thing that looks like a conventional X-Files episode at first. This isn't that. Like in F Emasculata, they are called in to support the U.S. Marshals in responding to a prison break, which is not their usual jam. And then in the course of that, they discover this plot where a company called Pink Pharmaceuticals is experimenting on prisoners in order to circumvent having to do clinical trials. I'm curious about exactly the mechanism. The episode is a little bit hand wavy about what they're doing with this data and how they're getting away with this, but definitely suggests some government malfeasance there too. And then in Pine Bluff Variant, Mulder and Scully have been conscripted into this counterterrorism operation against a militia group, which, you know, in the mid 1990s, what a perfect example. Both of these, like the fear of some contagious outbreak, both in the context of the Ebola outbreaks that would go on in the mid-90s and also in the context of the AIDS epidemic. These are really salient ideas for us. And then, of course, the prominence of militia groups throughout the 90s with Waco and then later with Oklahoma City. I mean, these are really resonant topical ideas during the time when these were airing. But they're doing these things that are kind of off the beaten track for the usual types of cases they get involved with. And they sort of stumble into the discovery in this counterterrorism operation that the government is conducting illegal bioweapons experiments, which is right up the X-Files alley in terms of uncovering these. Another feature these episodes share beyond this subject matter is something that comes up in a lot of these kind of stealth or quasi-mythology episodes, which is the supporting character who gets introduced into this world. We have Dean Norris, who most people will know as Hank from Breaking Bad in FMSculotta, who plays this kind of hard-boiled U.S. Marshal. And at first, he's quite an impediment to Mulder and to Mulder and Scully's involvement in general. But despite himself, over the course of the episode, he kind of has to admit that there's something bigger at work here. And actually, another funny coincidence here is that John Piper Ferguson, who plays the escaped fugitive, one of the escaped fugitives in FMSculotta, comes back in Christmas Carol and Emily, and he plays Detective Kresge, who at first is trying to get Scully off his case in this murder of Roberta Sim, but then he realizes there's something bigger going on. And I love these characters who get drawn into this world, who kind of put up barriers at first to Mulder and Scully's involvement in these cases because they're thinking of them as isolated tragedies, but they're actually part of this bigger constellation of government and corporate interference or experimentation. In Tempest, Fugit, and Max, Joe Spano's character, Mike Carr, is another one of these guys. And it makes you really wonder, how do they go back to their lives after this? Like, I want to get Marshall Tapia and Detective Kresge and Mike Millar all in one place for a drink to, like, unpack all these weird things that happened to them at work that one time and hear about, like,
that time you met Mulder Scully.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting. There isn't really a great parallel for that in Pine Bluff Variant because all of the folks that we're meeting are really enmeshed in this world already. We're meeting these militia characters who are kind of embedded in this. And then we have this, the head of the operation, like, obviously has a pretty good idea of what's going on. And so you have this wonderful confrontation between Mulder and Scully and him at the very end of the episode. And both episodes play a lot with kind of what do you share with the population that will enable them to protect themselves versus what will panic them. FMSculotta has a great juxtaposition between the cigarette-smoking man telling Mulder, you can't tell people about this contagion, it'll panic them, more people will die. And then Mulder's furious and he gets on the phone with Scully and she says, Mulder, we can't tell people about all this, people will die. So those are really important shared themes as well. But yeah, I'm very, very fond of both of these episodes and I think they're both kind of strong entries in this. They're connected to the broader themes of the mythology and they also really surface some of the wrongdoing. The Pink Pharmaceuticals work seems very reminiscent of the Roush Pharmaceuticals work that comes up in later on in Gethsemane and Redux. So yes, I'm very fond of these episodes. I'm curious what you guys think.
Well, to your last point there, actually, I wrote a blog on the XCast blog recently about how, you know, everything is considered government conspiracy, but there's also private interests that are mentioned in the series, one of them being the Roush Technologies. I hadn't thought about the pharmaceutical company in that episode, so that is another example of where it's not just government or government's not the focal point, it's actually a private interest that is, driving the conspiracy there. So yeah, I think that's a good connection there.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I feel like that's I remember your blog post. I thought that was interesting as well as something that's kind of prefigures some of, like, season 11 in a way. You know, with, like, I'm thinking of, like, about this and, like, My Struggle One and things like that. And just some of that emphasis on the, like, private industry that they bring in there.
Yeah.
Purley Services, that's what I was thinking of. But I also was thinking about, in both of those episodes, Cared When Mulder and Scully are used to kind of, like, further the agenda of whoever is involved, you know. And they're almost complicit in it against their knowledge or will to a degree. Right. And somebody in one of the listener mailbag comments that we'll go over talked about that, how some of these mythology episodes that are hybrids really show how enmeshed they are in the entire core of what's going on. You know, they sort of involve themselves in it, whether they wanted to or not. So that's really, those two are very interesting, I think, in that way.
And especially in the early seasons, you get a lot of episodes where, you as the audience know, and you get the sense Mulder and Scully know, sometimes they very explicitly state that they're being used. Like, they've been very suspicious of, like, why are you giving us this case, Skinner? And there's a lot of suspicion about that in FMSculotta, but it's not the first time it's come up. I mean, it kind of, to more humorous effect, that happens in The Host as well.
Yeah.
Where Skinner is doing that, like, so that Mulder can keep doing X-Files on the sly, but there is this kind of question of, there are several of these cases that they investigate where it's kind of like, your investigation is to use you to bring in information that the conspiracy is looking for and wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, that is one of the explanations of why they're able to continue their work, is because part of it is about them, their part in furthering some of these agendas, and the fact that they help spread misinformation or uncover some of the red herrings and everything that are set by these characters. So that is part of the reason why they're allowed to be on the X, you know, in their early years anyway.
It also seems like it's kind of a way for, especially the cigarette smoking man, to kind of rub Mulder's nose in it. You know, you can have what feels like freedom to you. You can continue to play your little games and you know, investigate your little cases, but this is going to keep going with or without you.
I was thinking, too, while you were talking about Anami and the cigarette smoking man using Scully to bring in information. So it sort of twisted that but it's similar.
Mulder is actually upset with Scully because, you know, he's because he knew that was, you know, most likely she was going to be used. It's like he has been used before.
I was just going to say, one of the most kind of terrifying aspects, I think, to Emasculata, and also, you know, like episodes like Wet Wired, which I know we're going to get into in a little bit, and Softlight, is it's not even really clear always what the purpose of these experiments is ultimately. And that's just so unsettling. You know, what are these various groups actually going to do with the results that they reach?
Mara, did you want to go with your second one?
I focused a lot on Wet Wired, which is one of my personal favorites. Again, I'd probably put that in the semi-mythology camp. Especially, you know, obviously it's got X in it and cigarette-smoking man. And so they're involved to a certain extent. We don't exactly know to what extent, which again is frightening. Just some observations about this particular episode. I thought it was a little more unique in the sense that Scully seems to really be the one who's instinctively drawing connections between watching the videos and then the behavior that develops as a result. And I think what's so powerful about Wet Wired and certain other episodes like F. Emasculata or Pine Bluff Variant is when the main characters are involved, I feel, you know, as a viewer, you're much more emotionally invested. You know, there's the sort of macro level of trust issues in that you don't exactly know what the government is doing with what they're doing. And then sort of on the micro level, you know, obviously the turmoil that Scully goes through in questioning her trust of Mulder and Mulder's trust of her. So I like those layers to it. And I also appreciate the fact that how much just reality is called into question, which I know they've played around with in other episodes, like Field Trip is a good example of that. And just visually, I think it's a very striking episode and sort of tonally very similar to some of the mythology episodes.
I was going to say that Wet Wired is part of a few episodes that are about like government mind control experiments. Like Blood is probably the first one that's sort of similar to Wet Wired, but you also have what I was going to talk about, which is Unusual Suspects. That's another one where, you know, sort of mind control experiments are being done. So you have this sort of, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but sort of threads through some of these semi-mythology episodes that deal with efforts to, you know, control the public.
That's interesting. Sleepless also kind of falls into that category. Season 2 seems to have a lot of these, and I wonder if it's because they were still, you know, you didn't quite have the arc of the abduction scenario plus the cancer scenario that was going to become so pivotal for the next couple seasons and was going to shape so many things. And I think that they were still, it seems like they were tossing out a few different threads of what the conspiracy could be and the kind of broader mythology could be. So you had, you know, purity control brought up in season one, and then you also had just the, you know, concealing the existence of alien life. And then you also had things like the government, you know, seeking to create super soldiers, which would obviously come back in a different way much later. and these other mind control experiments and things like that. So it's intriguing how they kind of picked the threads that they wanted to pull, like kind of braid into the broader mythology, but there are still all these strands of it that kind of run alongside.
Well, I think in the first couple of seasons, they were doing a lot of episodes where it was, the government was involved, and then sort of starting after like the Anasazi, when mythology really blew up, there was less of that, where they were doing other government conspiracies aside from the main one involving colonization. So I think that's certainly more something that happens in the beginning of the series. But you do have, some later episodes that are involved with that. Kitten is one from the most recent season. I think that qualifies as kind of a blood type episode, right, where experiments being done to create, I guess, more soldiers that were more extreme.
I think that goes too to the idea that Mara, I believe you were mentioning about not knowing, like the scary part is not knowing where it was going, so there were a lot of stories that were about like what would happen if you built a soldier that didn't need sleep. It was kind of before they got into that idea, that really codified idea of building the perfect being or building a super soldier. They had these different threads of it that, like Caridwen said, they braided together to be that. But I really liked it when they were sort of exploring in that time. Yeah, I agree. It would be sort of like pre-season 3, pre-Anasazi, when they were looking at different elements of it, and it was a little more integrated then.
And Eve is another example. That was probably the first one where a super soldier program is mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's very early on where that came.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten about Eve, but that's also such an, like, it's a perfect precursor to things like Permanum much later on in season 8, where this whole thing is about how can women's bodies be kind of co-opted and weaponized in order to further, these creepy experiments. Yeah, wow, I hadn't thought about that.
And it's interesting too that you mentioned that, because I wasn't even necessarily thinking about the women's bodies being co-opted, but it fits that idea of women's bodies being co-opted to then create the perfect being, that kind of all comes together too.
It's a recurring theme, I think, throughout the series. I know Darren Mooney talked a lot about that in some of his writings. Mm-hmm. A recurring theme of women's bodies being used in that way, of that sort of horror being involved. So, I do think that's a consistent thread.
I have one question on Wetwired. Do you think that combination of the myth arc and the standalone elements really works, like in the story? Because I think it really does in terms of the things we're talking about with what was woven together after that, before and after. But what do you think about the way it comes together in the story?
I think it comes together. I mean, it's established early on in the episode that because there is an informant that gives Mulder the lead on the case. So it doesn't really come as too much of a surprise, I think, as the episode develops into, okay, this is going on because someone, in the government is conducting these experiments on people. I mean, I think it works. It's one of my favorite episodes. So, I mean, I don't feel like these elements are too disparate and that they don't come together. I think it works really well.
I do as well. I wish maybe in some way they would have returned to the idea of mind control once the colonization storyline really got underway, because I think that could have been possibly utilized again. I mean, I think it was still very effective. And I think actually even having that sort of unnamed informant, which my understanding is they only had him because Stephen Williams wasn't able to film as many scenes. But I thought that was actually ended up working to their advantage because, again, it kind of drives home that fact of how many people, you wonder how many people are actually involved in all of these cover-ups.
Well, and it drives home that X was under suspicion, that he was under close watch. He couldn't be as involved as an informant as he was, and then obviously when he steps back too much of that, he gets killed. So it really helps to foreshadow the next couple of episodes and finish X's arc.
Yeah. I think there's an issue of anonymity there, too. I mean, we have like Deep Throat and we have X and the people that we know, but then a lot of the people that come, they either don't have names or they have nicknames but not human names, or like the cigarette smoking man later says he's gone by many names. So I think there's an aspect of that that adds a little bit of a sinister aspect to that. Having X in there, he's
don't know quite what he's up to, but he's still a familiar character, so there's a comfort in that, that there isn't, that you just have somebody that's anonymous.
Well, it seems like maybe there was like a certain level at which that people got to where they lost their names. Because you have like, you know, obviously some people involved in the conspiracy that go by their names, like Krycek and Marita and stuff. So obviously they're like on the same level to where they're still using their real names. But then people like Smoking Man and X and Deep Throat and Well Manicured Man, they've all achieved this level where they no longer go by names, by regular names. Or, you know, they don't let their real names be known, I guess, until, like, Deep Throat's killed and we see what his real name is on the tombstone. And eventually we find out Smoking Man's name, but those things are always kept a mystery to the characters.
To come back for a second to the mind control idea, I think that is a really important kind of missed opportunity, because we learn through, you know, Patient X and the Red and the Black and some of those other later mythology two-parters, that there is an aspect of control baked into these implants. Like once, you know, once Scully's life is saved by having the implant inserted in Redux, you know, her activities can be directed. And I actually think that is really underutilized in this series.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, like what? That's a huge life-changing, like, paradigm shift to have to live under, to know that she could be summoned anywhere at any point against her will. And it really is, it mirrors some of the, you know, the pursuit of Max or the pursuit of Duane Barry, that they feel like they can be, the aliens can find them wherever they want. And for Scully, it's like she can be moved wherever she needs to be moved, but she doesn't have any control or any say over that. And it's interesting in the context of those earlier mind control episodes, how little that, you know, that theme comes up. There's so many cases where it would have been very convenient for the conspiracy to be using the implant to control her. So it makes you wonder a little bit about kind of how those, what the mechanism of that is, and if, like, who actually is pulling the strings there, and under what circumstances can they?
Well, presumably that would have come back to, like, if we had actually seen colonization play out, that we would have seen the abductees be controlled and gathered in that way. I was going to say, on the sort of next episode I wanted to talk about was Unusual Suspects, where we do see the mind control thread again. Mm-hmm. And there it's sort of more explicitly linked to sort of the broader, you know, actually kind of gets linked there to what they suggested in Redux and Redux 2, that the aliens weren't real, that they were, you know, something that's created by the military-industrial complex. So we see Mulder gets exposed to the toxin or whatever in that episode, and he sees people as sort of alien-like, and, you know, we obviously see X involved in that, so it's another mind-control episode that X is involved in, and so it sort of follows up on some of those ideas as well.
I like that. I like that idea. And I think there's a, you know, potential positive contrast. Well, it's not positive that Mulder, you know, had done to him what was done to him that sort of brought out his capacities, you know, in the Biogenesis trilogy. But I think there was a positive aspect to that, that was sort of foreshadowed in Field Trip, that was more of that communication part. So like the, you know, more beneficial use of that ability versus using it again for like sinister purposes. And I think that they could have done, a lot more on both sides, actually, with that, with the sort of the controlling Scully, and then just also that sort of piece of how people communicate with each other.
Yeah, it is kind of wild that this period where, this very lengthy period of the show where Scully is, you know, susceptible to whatever control this implant has, I wonder what the fallout would be between that and Mulder having mind reading abilities all of a sudden in Biogenesis. I mean, right. God, right. What, you know, what a fundamental kind of loss of control for both of them. He's hearing things he doesn't know how to interpret or understand, and everybody around him is made vulnerable because of it. And, you know, Scully has this layer of physical vulnerability through her actions being able to be controlled.
There's also a slight, I mean, I don't want to go too overboard on this, but I feel like there's a slight hint in the Biogenesis trilogy that some signals are clearer than others to him. And I think that would have been interesting to see how that developed, you know, and then also develop for Scully, like the what's real versus what's manipulated kind of thing. That's just, I guess, wishful thinking. Adam, did you have more you wanted to talk about with Unusual Suspects, since I know that was one of your selections?
No, that was mainly it. Also, we do see, you know, X sees that Mulder's there, and he says nobody touches this man. So it does, you know, it does show there that he was already aware of Mulder and who he is, and possibly even that, you know, he wanted to use Mulder at some point. So he made sure he was protected from the cleanup crew. For an episode that's mainly concerned with explaining the origins of the Lone Gunman, it's very much an episode that, you know, plays into the mythic elements, especially coming right after the Redux episodes.
Cared one, did you have another one?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk for a quick second about Sign and Zeit and Closure. Just to say that one thing that I think is... These are another example of situations where Mulder and Scully are doing something that's a little bit out of their usual kind of bag of tricks in supporting with this child abduction case. And Mulder is kind of finding ways to make it an X-File anyway, looking into this idea of walk-ins. But I think that the fact that the Mulder family drama kind of sneaks up on us with his mother trying to get in touch with him and then us learning that she has taken her own life is it's such a shock to us in the same way that it's a shock to him. But it also it's a great example of a place where these trends or concepts kind of come out of nowhere in a few of these episodes. And we aren't expecting this to be about Samantha. Like, it's a missing child episode, but it's only thematically connected until we have this, you know, this massive trauma that Mulder suffers. And then you have this kind of additional sort of exploitation by this, you know, so-called psychic who's trying to kind of manipulate him and provide information and maybe has something useful and real to say. But you don't foresee these turning into the story that they're going to end up telling, and that it's going to end up being so connected to their kind of family tragedy. Right. So I find that really interesting.
I think it's also interesting, and it's sort of possible, like for a second, it's a possible alternative to the traditional myth arc story that we've known for almost 7 years at that point about Samantha's abduction. You know, like, was it really this man that has been doing a lot of this stuff? Which is a little bit far-fetched that it's this guy that dresses up as Santa. But at the same time, I think it does make you question, in the same way that we'll get to Paper Hearts, I think, in a minute, how that makes, you know, it sort of like puts a little seed of doubt in your mind about, like, did this formative event that started Mulder on this quest, did that really even happen in the way that he thinks it happened?
I think
really reminiscent of Unusual Suspects too. Did it really happen the way you think it happened is kind of a question that comes up a lot throughout the series.
Right. I mean, it suggests the fact that Mulder was exposed to that also suggests that might have, it suggests that his paranoia about these things also came from his exposure to that. So that actually may have made him more paranoid, you know, toward and likely to believe in these things.
I know some people, you know, have not liked sort of the alternative of Sign and Zeit after Two Fathers and One Son, but I see it more as a segue. I think it ties in more to the mythology and just as not as an alternate in reality, but just as like addressing Mulder's experience more. But I don't know if that's something you all thought about.
I don't think it's alternate because it is like the truthful explanation to what happened.
Right.
They are weird episodes in that they're totally necessary episodes and part of the mythology, but they don't really feel like traditional mythology because that's not really what the focus is, you know, the main parts of the plot are child abductions from an actual child killer and these walk-in spirits that have taken them, you know, to prevent their suffering. So those things aren't really tied to mythology, but they're totally necessary because they explain what happened to Samantha. And, you know, you do see Smoking Man and come up in Closure and Jeffrey Spender's footprints next to Samantha's. So, I mean, it does have those mythology. It's kind of like a semi-mythology two-parter that's, you know, it's sort of unique.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think it by the end of it, is so clear-cut as being part of the mythology storyline, but it sneaks up on us in a way. You know, when you're... when you're watching Tunguska and Terma, or when you're watching Patient X and the Red and the Black, it's no question from the beginning, like, what kind of episode you're watching. But this is a weird one, because it by the end is so unequivocally part of the world. But yeah, it's a surprise as it unfolds.
Yeah, if it was one episode, I would say maybe it would be a stealth mythology. If it was one episode and the first half was what happens in Xehanuzai, then you could say, and then Closure was the second half, then, you know, that's clearly where it becomes important to the mythology.
I think about that with, like, sort of the ending, you know, becoming more, either a second part or an ending of an episode becoming more important in the mythology, with Christmas Carol and Emily as well, because those are ones that, well, the Christmas Carol kind of sneaks up on you, I think, in the end.
That's another example where Christmas Carol really isn't what you think of as a mythology episode, but obviously Emily is, so it's sort of stealth segue.
And I think with some of those episodes, it's easy to see because of the time of year it comes on. We all were conditioned to think, like, oh, it's a sweeps period, or it's November, so they're going to have a mythology episode.
But exactly.
And so even with some of those, though, like with Christmas Carol, I really, you know, I wasn't expecting what I got, I guess. And I'll just, like, piggyback really quickly on that. I think that on the stealth side, the biggest surprise to me was Leonard Betts, because there's nothing about it at all that suggests it has anything to do with the myth arc until the end. And it's just very quick. But I thought that was really effective. And Christmas Carol to me wasn't as surprising, but it still had that little, like, sort of punch of surprise at the end that turns you in an entirely different, you know, direction, like, back towards that central story. And I rather like that. I kind of like having that twist in the end as well, rather than knowing what...
Leonard Betts is such a cool example of this, because really, you know, there's nothing about it except for the last, minute and a half, 2 minutes, that is suggestive that it has any kind of... And it's not, you know, it's not particularly thematically connected to the mythology at all. The story isn't, you know, it doesn't tap into any of these real themes. It's just, like, kind of a straight up monster episode right up until he says those words to Scully in the ambulance. And that is, I mean, maybe the ultimate stealth.
Yeah. And I'm one of those people that wishes that Leonard Betts flowed right into Memento Mori. Like, I like that.
Yeah, okay.
Better than going into Never Again and then Memento Mori.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here.
I would agree with that. I think that would have made the mythological connection and the story overall stronger too. And we talked about this in, like, another discussion about the ordering of episodes. And I do tend to think, like, whatever order they've shown them in, for whatever reason, is the order that they meant for us to see them. But I do think there are a few exceptions. That would be one of them.
Because Leonard Betts was moved up because it was the better Super Bowl episode instead of Never Again. Otherwise, it would have been in that order. So it was moved up, sort of, not really for episode
narrative, right?
But because it was going to be the better episode to air after the Super Bowl and get that big audience.
It would have been very strange to have Never Again be airing after the Super Bowl. but it is. I do think it's such a shame that all of the psychological territory that we explore in Never Again, you know, in some ways we end up just chalking it up to, like, oh, well, Scully's thinking a lot about mortality right now. And I think that does kind of cheapen that investigation a little bit. But yeah, that the other one that really gets me is Kaddish airing right after Memento Mori, because it was written when Memento Mori was just a twinkle in the writer's eyes, because it was such a last-minute addition to the season. And it really shows. I mean, in Kaddish, it's a lovely episode, but I think it really suffers from coming right after this. Enormous plot beat.
Pretty jarring. And I don't feel like you see that a whole lot in television now. I do feel like it's much more thought out in terms of the order and the kind of the continuity, at least what I'm watching now currently.
Yeah. But now when I go back and rewatch episodes, I don't really care about that anymore. Because, you know, like, I'm used to it now, I guess. Like, I already know what's happened, so I don't care about it. It doesn't feel jarring to me anymore because I already know how it is. But yeah, obviously, first run, seeing it for the first time, I can see that.
I think for people watching, like, current television, it might be, and then watching X-Files, it would be different because it is a different style and a different era. But I mean, and it could be just because I was watching TV more actively with X-Files in that era, but I sort of like the layering effect that you get from things being seated in an episode and then coming out in another episode, and you have to, like, put it together a little bit more rather than having it be planned out.
It does give a little bit more agency to the audience I mean, you don't end up having to defer to what story the writer wants to tell or the producers want to tell when they're assembling these. It gives a little bit more latitude for your own thoughts and interpretations and, you know, things that were just coincidences or were just incidental. You really do have the opportunity to stitch those together. And I think that these stealth and sort of quasi-mythology episodes do that in a really important way and provide a lot of opportunities for it, because the connections are often ones that we're interpolating a little bit into the text of the episodes, and that we're sort of discovering because we're seeing it in a broader context. I don't think that the script writing process of Sleepless necessarily assumed that, you know, we were going to have a super soldier story coming up later. I don't think that the script writing process of Blood assumed that there were going to be other mind control stories, and that the mind control would become instrumental to the way that the implants functioned. But I think it's tremendously interesting to go back and find those connections, even ones that weren't deliberate, and sort of examine what it tells us about the themes that were important to the folks who are telling these stories.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because a large part of it wasn't deliberate. It just ended up being a way that we can look back at it and see, oh, it's interesting that these episodes sort of line up with each other, or at least they're similar. So mm-hmm. it is very interesting, and it makes so that we can do podcasts like these.
Right. I mean, 25 odd years late in 2019, I'm still talking about it. You're still finding things, and you know that the writers were able to write about themes that interested them, and you can kind of go back and look at what those were, what those might have been, you know, after all this time, I think. Because I don't know that it would be as interesting or as fun to look back at a show that was like extremely well structured and maybe a great show in its time, but if it's like this happened and that happened and then that happened.
I agree with you.
What else?
The show serialized now, there may not, you know, there may be a lot less to sort of talk about because they're so planned out and they're so clear in what story they're telling that, you know, it may make for, you know, a good bingeable TV experience. But yeah, are you going to be talking about it years later? You know, maybe not.
Yeah. Okay, Mara, were you going to talk about Paper Hearts? Whatever you want to talk about next, we can move on to that.
Yeah, Paper Hearts, I think, in the way that you were saying, like, closure is successful in just that twist at the end. And I think with Paper Hearts, I kept thinking to myself, I wish I could see it for the first time again and experience mm-hmm. that sort of sensation of the rug being pulled out from under you and really questioning, well, has this all been a figment of Mulder's imagination all along? And I just think, again, the casting in that, I think, is excellent. Just because he does seem so untrustworthy, so conniving. Yeah, I think that's one of the all-time greats.
I was going to save all the comments for the end, but I have one that's like really specific to this, so I'm going to see what you guys think of it. First of all, Michael Little wrote that he thinks the biggest flaw of the third season, this is going to connect, I promise. Biggest flaw of the third season is where the show tries really hard to separate the mythology and the standalones. And then he says that Wet Wired and Avatar are sort of hybrids. And he thinks that season two did a much better job of making the conspiracy seem like it's everywhere, which is another thing that comes out a lot. And it had the effect of making it seem like it could be all a hoax and therefore more believable. So he's talking about season two and how season three doesn't really have that. And then Ella Markovsky, she debunked the idea that Paper Hearts could have been an alternative to Samantha's abduction and said that Mulder had already seen the child Samantha clones in Herrenvolk. And so in her mind, Paper Hearts always felt like it was more, could have been a part of season three in that regard and would have been more of a surprise in season three. So kind of like seeing it again in that context would have worked mm-hmm. a little bit. I thought that was really, really, both of those points were really interesting. And then Michael Little also says that he thinks it's the best, Paper Hearts is the best sort of pseudo-mythology episode. I just wonder what you all thought of that.
I think the conspiracy everywhere stuff was less, I think he said it was more believable. I think that makes it less believable as opposed to having a, you know, the syndicate, which is a sort of a single group that, again, government people, but also private interests that sort of come together and decide that they're going to have their own global enterprise that, I mean, actually, yeah, both are really not likely, but that seems to me more relatable to reality than, oh, everything is a government conspiracy. That seems to be more of the unrealistic stuff. What was the other stuff? I would say, I think it's mostly an emotional, Mulder's sort of willing to maybe forget about some of those things because he really wants an explanation, whether it's that or not. But I think you could explain it as Mulder thinks that the Samantha clones are misdirection meant to, you know, distract him as opposed to being the reality. And the reality might be that, you know, Samantha was killed by this child killer. So it doesn't really bother me. It bothers me more later when it's sort of done again. And it's like, because Mulder knows better at that point. But in Paper Hearts, it works.
I think that point about it being more or less believable when the conspiracy is everywhere versus when we know it's the syndicate and we know kind of what is encompassed in their specific plans. I guess the question of believability to me is a little bit secondary to the question of how frightening and unsettling is it. I do think that it becomes more containable and seems like something that's more possible to fight when the syndicate is made explicit. Whereas before we know about them, before they are a group with a name, and before we know their faces and see them meeting and things like that, it does feel like there's just this, you know, this broad sweeping power to control and to, you know, exploit. And that is really frightening, especially in season two. But I think both of those sides of that story are really interesting and important. I mean, you can't have a villain who is faceless and shapeless forever, because you need to be able to have some complexity and some direct stakes. And so I know people differ about this, but I think it was actually a really good move to name, you know, the syndicate and give it people's faces and let us see them meet and let us understand that they are humans with shortcomings and that their motivations are, you know, sometimes these really broad and sweeping ones, and sometimes they're just these very human acts of selfishness or spite. Yeah, I actually think that's a really interesting story.
Do you think, I didn't mean to like take us too far away from Paper Hearts, but do you think, like, in that vein, that having the individual story of Paper Hearts be this, you know, as Michael Little said, like the ideal quasi-mythology episode, do you think that that detracts from what they were building with the conspiracy at that time that it came around in season four? Or do you just see it as a good sort of hybrid episode?
Yeah, I don't think it distracts at all. I mean, I think it's just such a well-written and done episode that I feel like you don't even think about those things. And it's really, you understand from an emotional point of view why Mulder might suspend other things that he knows too. Because he is tricked by this person, and because he wants this to be over, really. But at the same time, ultimately, he exposes Roach as a liar because he takes him to, you know, the wrong house, and Roach can't tell that it's the wrong house. So obviously he figures out that he's full of shit. So,
and I mean, I do think that the reversals that are a little bit more, you know, the situations where Mulder's confronted with the possibility that, oh, maybe all of this was a lie. Maybe everything that I thought I knew was a hoax. I think some of those work better than others in the course of the series, but I really like how self-contained Paper Hearts is in that way, and that it says, okay, we're building to something here, and we have a broader story that we're telling about what happened to Samantha's abduction and what the syndicate is doing, but let's just entertain this idea for a second, and let's do it with Tom Noonan, who, you know, acts the hell out of every single scene he's in, and who is a tremendously convincing manipulator and a really, you know, clearly, you know, an obvious villain to the families whose children he did abduct. And let's try this idea on for a second and see if it fits and see how Mulder would react to it. I think it's fantastic, and I think it still works really well in the position in which it airs.
Well, and we see at the different points in the series that Mulder is at different times willing to think that his beliefs might be wrong. I mean, we see it later, just after Paper Hearts with Redux, where he's convinced that, you know, maybe the conspiracy wasn't real at all, that aliens aren't, you know, really there. It was just all made up. And then we see it again with My Struggle, where he it has sort of the same. So, you know, it's not the first time that it's not the only time that Mulder questions what he believes.
And Mara, did you have anything else on Paper Hearts?
I think on a logical level, I mean, I think you all touched upon this, but on a logical level as a viewer, I think you do realize that this story is probably ultimately not going to be the true story, but you kind of go along for the sort of the emotional ride of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so successful. And plus, I think X-Files, sometimes the most frightening monsters are the ones that actually are not monsters in the way that we think of them in the X-Files realm. Not so much the squeeze or, you know, those type of monsters, but the ones that truly do exist.
I think having Mrs. Mulder in there as well adds that element of, like, this kind of could be part of the mythology, maybe, you know, just introducing that scene with her character. Adam, would you like to go ahead with, I think you had SR-819?
Yeah, I would also mention Ghoulie is clearly a self-mythology where, you know, you wouldn't think from the teaser that it has to do, but obviously we realize that it's William. That's probably the most recent example of a stealth mythology. But yeah, SR-819 is an interesting one because, again, it's sort of semi-mythology. It's not really the basis of the story, but there are things that connect. You know, we see Senator Matheson again. We see some of the agents that are involved. They're from Tunisia, which is, you know, where Strughold was. And obviously, at the end, we see that the person who has infected Skinner with these nanobots is Krychek, and we see that plot line play out over the next, you know, few seasons, where Krychek has that hold over Skinner,
mm-hmm.
all the way to existence, where, you know, Skinner finally kills Krychek. It's one of those episodes that it's not a full mythology, hardcore mythology episode in itself, but you have to watch it anyway because it's you'll see plots from that continue into mythology episodes later.
We can go over a few of the listener comments then if you all want, and then just like chime in if you have any thoughts. So we'll start with Carl Sweeney, our very own Carl Sweeney. He says, I like it when the series deals with the status of the X-Files division itself. I consider this an important element in the mythology. I found season 11's This an interesting episode. So that, I thought that was kind of cool that he likes that sort of self-reflexive, like, look at the division and why it's there.
Yeah, I mean, we find out that the X-Files have been made electronic records, and mm-hmm. that those records have been possibly utilized by, you know, private interests. Again, that sort of comes up, and obviously Erica Price is somebody who's a syndicate member but she runs a company, and she's private interest that's involved. So yeah, that's another recent example of where those same themes come up.
Yeah.
There's a lot more of these than you would think. You really imagine until when you start thinking about it that there's because you tend to think that there's just these two type episodes, but there are more that sort of overlap than you would think.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've been really struck by that too in this conversation that, you know, as we were preparing to have this roundtable, I felt like I could make a list of a good, you know, like 8 or 10 episodes that seem to fall into this bucket and we all have covered. But the more we dig into it, the more of those connections there are. And the more, you know, there is sort of, it's less of a, you know, binary state and more of a spectrum of how enmeshed in the mythology a given episode is.
I think so too. I mean, I thought they were all going to be more related than most of us think, but then it's the situation you described where you start and then one thing leads to the next. You know, I think about like episodes that seem like standalones that then either turn into mythology or have those elements of the mythology in them. Clara Cook asked, would Nisei and 731 fall into this category? And I hadn't really thought about those before. I hadn't thought about mythology episodes that have, where we know their mythology, but they also have a standalone element. She says that the monster of the week is kind of in the episode because of the hybrids and the leprosy sufferers. There's that aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And along those same lines, I'll read this one from Andrew Levitt. He lists Piper Maru, and he says, at the first viewing, apart from a few scenes, like the one with Skinner and Scully in the hall, it plays out like a monster of the week until Mulder links it back to the talus from Nisei. And then he says it's not really until Krycek shows up in Act 3 that it becomes a full-blown mythology episode. I thought that was really interesting, especially given that earlier remark from Michael Little about Season 3 not having the same sort of trying to separate those, but then there are these mythology episodes that, like, I feel like we know their mythology going in, but then they do have those standalone elements too, so it's difficult.
Yeah, I don't really think episodes is not street mythology. I mean, they follow up on, you know, Neat State 731 follows up on the hybrid experiments and the Axis scientists that were brought over to work on those. And yeah, Piper Moreau, maybe, but once you understand that what the black oil is in by Apocrypha, you understand that it is mythology. And I do believe, like, the smoking man appears in Piper Moreau, so I don't think that those really are part of what we're talking about here.
So I'm going to go to Sarah Ford, who talks about Ephemasculata, and she says it's one of the best examples of blending a thrilling X-File with a vast government cover-up. And she also mentions that Mulder and Scully's conversation, where they debate whether telling the truth will cause more harm than good, is really interesting because it's almost as if Mulder and Scully are having a conversation that a young Bill Mulder and the cigarette-smoking man might have had years prior.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really interesting, yeah, character comparison as well.
That is interesting because that might be a philosophical question for the show, because obviously Mulder has a very strict, you know, the public should know everything point of view, but Scully's a bit more conservative with it. But, you know, the government has the right to, you know, to cover up some things, you know, that's necessary. So that discussion playing out just doesn't make sense.
Following a little bit on that, Tony Black says, Travelers is one that may go unrepresented. I really dig that episode, and while it has mythology aspects, it's certainly more angled toward the weird monster aspect and doesn't really directly relate to the work of the Syndicate. It's more an example, in his opinion, of how the X-Files would have used a bigger alien plotline if it hadn't gone full personal stakes mythology with Mulder and Scully, where everything was tied together a bit more. So that's an interesting angle on it, I thought, too.
A great point. It does make you wonder about what direction would the mythology have taken if they hadn't decided to, like, if Gillian Anderson hadn't gotten pregnant before season two and they hadn't had to do the abduction and then hadn't had to do the cancer as a result of that, and then had this all have these incredibly intense personal stakes for our characters here, would Mulder and Scully themselves have been as material to the pursuit of the story, and how might it have played out differently?
You yourself, Adam, said, I think it serves to show that these storylines and characters don't just disappear when it's a Monster of the Week episode instead of a mythology episode. And I really love that, because like we talked about, like, it's just, you know, all so tangled together.
Oh, yeah, I forgot I said that. Yeah, that's another great point, Adam. I'm glad you commented that. No. I do like that, because, you know, again, we tend to think of mythology and Monster of the Week is sort of separation of church and state with the show, but when you have these type of episodes, it shows that, oh, you know, what happened last week didn't still matters. It's still going to play out. So I do think it helps with the show that way.
Jocelyn Rojas said, hybrids are a gem in the show. She's very enthusiastic on this topic. So they set hybrids are a gem in the show. They set up background information, historical events, off-screen events, and even set timelines. Hybrids rock. I once mapped vaccine development, and it was partially supported from data from the hybrid episodes. And then she lists Founder's mutation as the, she says it's the mother of all hybrids, pun intended. And then she also mentions Ice, Eve, Blood, and Red Museum, which we've all talked about. I thought that was interesting, the point about it setting up, kind of like the layering effect, setting up the information that then the mythology, you know, can use without having to have it, like, be told again in every episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't disagree with her take on that. I think they serve such an important purpose in that way, because, you know, you can't just have every mythology, like, every clear-cut mythology episode be given over to constant, like, re-exposition. So this is a really, the hybrids are a wonderful way of kind of keeping those themes top of mind so that when they come around the next time really explicitly in a very clear-cut mythology episode, you know, the audience knows what to do with them. Yeah, and I share her enthusiasm for this. These are some of my, the Ephemasculata, Wet Wired, Pine Bluff Variant, like, these are some of my favorite episodes of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Mark Rolston who was Richard Odin in Red Museum, was Bud Lapierre in Sign and Sight Enclosure. He was the father, Amberlynn's father. That was a good call on that one. That was like from an hour ago that we were talking about that, but I found them. Do you guys have any other thoughts about it that you wanted to mention before we all go?
No, I think this was a great discussion.
I feel like we like just got the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's a lot more that could be covered.
Sure. Yeah, this is an absolute pleasure. I'm so glad we got to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure there are more episodes we can find, because again, there are a lot more of these than you would think off the top of your head. But when you really dive in, you're like, oh yeah. So, and you guys have made me see more connections too. So it's pretty fun.
Thank you all for joining us for this conversation. And where can we find you guys online?
My Twitter is XF_lost episodes, which I use for the X-Files Virtual Season 12 that me and some other writers have done. The website for that is virtualseasons.x-sites.org.
Great, thank you.
And I'm on...
I'm nowhere other than Facebook. So you can just find me under Maura Jaeger on Facebook.
All right. On Twitter at Caradwin, or you can find me in the XCast Facebook group.
And I am Marlene MHS on Twitter and Marlene Stimmy on Facebook, where I am usually in the XCast basement group discussing all manner of interesting topics that people bring up on a daily basis. So it's a great place for interesting conversation. Thank you everybody for joining us. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you guys. And always remember, trust no one.
The XCast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The XCast, and on Facebook if you type in The XCast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The XCast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXCast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXCast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.